How to contain Ebola today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The DRC has struggled to stop the spread of the Ebola virus, but neighboring Uganda has been there before.
For you to be able to contain such an outbreak, you need community support, you need political support, which is lacking in DRC.
In Hong Kong, activists look abroad for help.
I hope that politicians in your countries will ask questions in Parliament, in Congress. Just let the whole world know what the nasty things they are doing to little Hong Kong.
And the problem of deep fakes has real consequences.
I was receiving screenshots of the video on my WhatsApp, Twitter, or Facebook, and I felt like I was naked for the world.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. How do you stop the spread of Ebola? That's the challenge Uganda is facing today. In Western Uganda this week, a 50-year-old woman and her 5-year-old grandson infected with the Ebola virus both died. The death toll from the virus in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo is far worse. Ebola has claimed nearly 1,400 lives in the DRC. This current outbreak is the second largest ever. Uganda has been preparing for months for the possible spread of Ebola. We reached out to Uganda's health minister, Sarah Achieng Opendi, to find out what's being done to protect people there.
We had 3 cases, 2 have passed on, and we have 1 3-year-old kid who is still in the isolation facility.
The outbreak in the Democratic Republic has been growing since it was first reported. What kind of preparations have you been making in Uganda?
So with us, we actually knew that would definitely get an Ebola case. But the question was when. So we have actually been very prepared with isolation facilities, our health workers, the communities have all been on alert, and we have been screening all the cases that come into the country. The situation is actually under control.
The 3 cases that have occurred in Uganda, they were people who traveled to the Democratic Republic of Congo and then returned. Are any actions being taken at the border, or are there any kind of restrictions on travel to avoid further cases?
We cannot restrict that because there is a lot of cross-border trade that goes on between DRC and Uganda. And actually, on a daily basis, they have a minimum of about 5,000 people crossing into Uganda to do different businesses. So all we do is really ensure that these people that come in are actually screened. And where they are suspected cases, they are actually isolated for a while, monitored, and if they don't develop further signs, then they are released.
The World Health Organization Emergency Committee meets tomorrow, and the group's going to decide if the outbreak should now be deemed a public health emergency. What would this mean for how you manage an Ebola outbreak?
As a country, since there was an outbreak in DRC, we've been having our national task force meetings every week. The district task force meetings in those districts bordering DRC have been meeting weekly to try and see, identify if there are any gaps and see how to address them. So really, as a country, we have been prepared. It's not something that has caught us by surprise. The health workers are all on alert. We have the village health teams who are doing community sensitization. They are also on the ground in keeping the population aware of what they are supposed to do. So really, the population is aware of Ebola. They know the symptoms, and they know exactly what to do.
Besides not shaking hands, what other precautions are people taking or are you advising?
Even the other precautions are taken care of. People are told not to share. People who drink and share the same drink using the same cups, and even avoiding public places, funerals and so on.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, efforts to contain the spread of Ebola have been hindered in part by suspicion towards foreign medical assistance, and there have been regular attacks on health facilities. Is this a concern in Uganda?
For you to be able to contain such an outbreak, you need community support, you need political support, you need all the other stakeholders' support, which is lacking in DRC. So the political leaders in the districts of Kasese and all the others bordering DRC are all on board sensitizing the communities because people believe in them.
Our citizens in Uganda, are they as suspicious of foreign health workers as those in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
No, we don't have. We don't have that kind of thing. That's why even the vaccines, people readily accepted to be vaccinated. We didn't have a challenge.
Sarah Achieng Opendi is Uganda's State Minister of Health for General Duties. She's been speaking to us from Kampala. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you so much.
Two fuel tankers came under attack today in the Gulf of Oman. Both ships are severely damaged and their crews had to be rescued. Markets reacted immediately, with global oil prices shooting up 4%. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed Iran.
Iran is lashing out because the regime wants our successful maximum pressure campaign lifted. No economic sanctions entitle the Islamic Republic to attack innocent civilians, disrupt global oil markets, and engage in nuclear blackmail.
The Iranians said they had nothing to do with the explosions on the two tankers, but the implications of today's attacks are serious, given the rising tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Meanwhile, three U.S. allies are working with Iran to find a new way to do business. The Trump administration imposed additional sanctions on the country after President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear agreement more than a year ago. Those sanctions work through a banking system called SWIFT. It facilitates most global financial transactions. But the Europeans have worked for months to set up a new payment system for Iran outside of SWIFT. It's called the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX. No surprise, the U.S. has some problems with it. Ellie Garenmaya follows all this for the European Council on Foreign Relations.
So INSTEX is the acronym name for a new instrument that certain European countries are backing through governmental support, particularly Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, who are parties to the nuclear deal with Iran, which, of course, President Trump left over a year ago. So these European countries have been facing an uphill battle to preserve the deal, because a big important part of the deal is that Iran needs to get some sort of an economic dividend in return for restraining and restricting its nuclear program. The world's banking sector, because of U.S. sanctions, have really stopped and shut the door to any business with Iran, even in areas like humanitarian trade that are in theory possible under U.S. sanctions framework.
So that's technically fine according to world trade rules currently, isn't it?
Well, it's important to remember right now the only obstacle to trade with Iran in terms of regulation is actually unilateral U.S. sanctions. So the rest of the world has no legal restrictions. The large, vast amounts of trade with Iran is permitted.
So if this is all legal and above board, what could the U.S. do to undermine it?
Well, the main problem that the U.S. Has signaled that it would have with this mechanism is if it starts to trade in goods or invest in areas which are currently targeted by U.S. sanctions. So what we've had, for example, the Secretary of State Pompeo say is, as long as this mechanism is restricted to humanitarian trade, which the European side says for the foreseeable future, this mechanism will be restricted in its scope to humanitarian trade, then the American side doesn't have a problem with it because this trade is already permitted even under U.S. sanctions framework. Now, where it gets thorny for the U.S. position is if, for example, this mechanism eventually starts to plug in to oil trade with Iran. And that's obviously an area where under President Trump's maximum pressure campaign, they're really focused on turning up the pressure on Iran. Now, if the U.S. Sees such activity, it could possibly go after this mechanism by, for example, directly sanctioning INSTEX or sanctioning European companies that are using it. This would be quite a drastic and aggressive move against not an adversary like Iran for the United States, but an ally like France or Germany or the United Kingdom.
How likely is that?
What we're seeing in the last few weeks is that there is a debate going on inside of the administration. And we have the State Department, most people are saying, weighing on the side of saying, let's give some breathing space to our European allies. First of all, the trade that's happening under this mechanism is restricted to areas that are permitted under U.S. sanctions framework, so there isn't a direct clash. And also, I think the Americans are quite keen to get European allies on board for other pushback strategy on Iran, particularly on the regional issues. Now, what we're hearing is that the National Security Council, under John Bolton's guidance, is pushing for a much more aggressive stance on insects, including talk of sanctioning entities that are linked to insects, for example, the Iranian counterpart, which has been set up, or trying to pressure companies in Europe to stay very clear from this mechanism.
Ellie Garenmaya is a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks a lot, Ellie.
Pleasure.
Tomorrow marks 2 years since a fire engulfed Grenfell Tower in London. 72 people died in the blaze. It was the deadliest residential fire in Britain since World War II. The fire and its aftermath have been tough for survivors and relatives, made more so by the authorities' slow response. It's a response that in the minds of many has brought shame on Britain. The World's Orla Barry reports from London.
This is Tiago Alves.
It's been a week where we're trying to make sure that people put Grenfell back on the spotlight.
Alves lived on the 13th floor of Grenfell Tower with his father, mother and younger sister. They all managed to escape from the building that night.
I'm obviously still suffering with mental health problems, anxiety, depression. I go see a psychologist every week. My parents are doing the same and so is my sister.
Fire Brigade.
Yeah, hello. Hi. In the fire, flat 16 Grenfell Tower.
This was the first call to the London Fire Services in the early morning of June 14th, 2017.
Right, okay. Quick.
They're on their way already. Yes, I know it's burning, but they are on their way.
Emergency services told residents to stay in their apartments and wait for help. Miguel Alves, Tiago's father, ignored the advice.
I think on my mind it was to save myself because fire on the fourth floor, I'm on the 13th floor, is like a trap. Every minute, it was worse inside of the tower.
In the hours and days following the blaze, anger quickly bubbled up. Many Grenfell residents had been worried when the outside of the building was retrofitted in the years leading up to the fire. This so-called cladding added insulation and aimed to improve the appearance of the tower block. But residents complained that some windows no longer close properly and even the doors lacked a self-closing mechanism, essential for fire safety.
The fundamental question which lies at the heart of our work is how, in London, in 2017, a domestic fire developed so quickly and so catastrophically that an entire high-rise block was engulfed.
This public inquiry, set up a couple of months after the blaze, heard from survivors, relatives, experts and firefighters who tried to save those trapped inside Grenfell.
I could hear them both coughing and crying. It was about a 35-minute mark that Zainab told me her son's dead. He's dead and I don't want to be here anymore and I want to be with him. And it was at that point, you know, I had to try and tell her not to be like, don't, you know, you ain't giving up on me now.
2 years on from the fire, the inquiry has not yet delivered its findings. The long delay has led survivors and relatives to seek answers and compensation elsewhere.
The complaint that we have filed is on behalf of 69 of the families who lost loved ones and 177 of the survivors who have sustained life-altering injuries.
This is attorney Jeffrey Goodman.
It is filed here in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia, and it names three defendants: Arconic Inc., Celotex Corporation, and the third defendant is Whirlpool Corporation from Michigan.
The three US companies have said only that they're cooperating with the UK inquiry. The decision to pursue legal action in America has divided Grenfell residents. One told the BBC he didn't feel it was morally right to take action in the US. Another described it as ugly and a distraction. Many survivors feel it's their mission to get to the bottom of what happened that night and prevent it ever happening again. In particular, they want to see the removal of the combustible cladding that has been fitted on many buildings besides Grenfell. This is key for survivor Tiago Alves.
If we don't do anything to change, those people will have died in vain.
But for Alves, the next 24 hours is about being with his family and the Grenfell community.
The 14th of June, from now on, will be remembered as the day that we remember those who lost their lives.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry, London.
And you're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Things were quieter today in Hong Kong, but it's not likely that the protests are over. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators marched this week. They're not demanding new freedoms or civil rights. They're trying to hold on to the ones they've had for a long time. When Great Britain handed Hong Kong back to China in 1997, the Chinese government agreed to protect the territory's semi-autonomous legal and political system. Emily Lau is a pro-democracy politician who served on Hong Kong's Legislative Council for 25 years. When we called her earlier, we'd been hearing reports that police were searching for activists in dormitories at a Hong Kong university. Lau called those reports shocking.
I don't know what the police are doing. Yesterday, they went to hospitals to arrest people. And now today, they go to university dormitories. And of course, we must get the police to come out and stop that and to behave in a civilized way. And they should know the whole world is watching. So we don't really want people to think that Hong Kong is a real police state. And so this sort of behavior is unacceptable.
Do you worry that Hong Kong is being pulled into the larger clash over Asia's future, pitting America and China against one another in increasingly worrisome ways?
And maybe it's inevitable, but I think Hong Kong, we have been part of China for 20-odd years. But we managed to have a separate existence under China's policy of one country, two systems, whereby the people here, the 7 million, can enjoy freedoms, personal safety, and the rule of law, independence of the judiciary, which the people in the rest of the People's Republic of China do not enjoy. So this is something quite remarkable. But now it seems the Chinese government is getting fed up with us and they want to take away those things. So you can see the city is fighting back. That's why we have a million people marching.
Emily, at this point, do you wish Hong Kong could separate from China and have full autonomy?
Most of the Hong Kong people do not want it. I have been a representative of the people for a quarter of a century. When I started out, of course, I said I believe in self-determination. But when the British were negotiating with China about the future of Hong Kong in the 1980s, there was no self-determination movement because the vast majority of the people here accept that they are Chinese. And then Hong Kong is Chinese territory. So if I'm going to represent them, I have to respect their wish. And now we are not fighting for independence. We are just fighting for the Chinese to keep the promise that they made to us of one country, two systems, and don't destroy our free lifestyle.
Now, it seems like this movement, though, is running out of options. I mean, its youth leaders have tried to join the government only to be jailed, disqualified, accused of being stooges for China's rivals. What more can the protesters and can people in Hong Kong do?
Well, if the city is in turmoil like this, the business people are very upset. And when they are upset, they will want to do something too. So many things are happening. So just don't say we are a lost cause.
But what leverage at this point does the opposition have to move its cause forward?
We are not very big. I mean, political parties are very small. But what you have seen on the streets of Hong Kong is really people power. And there is no one really that can organize these people to come onto the streets. Not about this 1 million people march or the big gatherings outside the Legislative Council and government complex. And it's just the people themselves. And that's what the Hong Kong people are like. I don't think they want to be manipulated or organized. But when they know something is important, they will turn up.
Emily, what is your next move specifically? What are you going to do next?
You know, they have just organized another march on Sunday. This time we will march in black.
Are you going to go?
I will be there. And I hope that politicians in your countries will ask questions in Parliament, in Congress. Just let the whole world know what the nasty things they are doing to little Hong Kong.
Pro-democracy activist Emily Lau served on Hong Kong's Legislative Council for 25 years. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The little Portuguese island of Porto Santo in the Atlantic Ocean has some big plans. It wants to give up fossil fuels once and for all. To do that, the island is experimenting with a new form of energy storage that could catch on globally. Here's the BBC's Roger Harabin.
Like many small islands, Porto Santo relies on imported energy. It comes in the form of diesel and fuel oil. It's dirty and polluting, and it's expensive. The local government would like to get rid of it.
Porto Santo is aiming to become the first world fossil-free island.
That's a promo video from local government. Their big thing is a radical plan to switch away from diesel-powered generation and on to wind and solar energy. The key question is how to secure that energy at night time when there's no wind or sun. The answer is this electric car. It looks like a standard model filling up its battery when the sun is shining. But there's a crucial innovation here. This car's battery can work in reverse when the sun goes down and give energy back to the grid to power people's homes. Here's Eric Funtum from the car's maker, Renault.
Everybody is using his car 10, 15, 20% of the time for driving, and the rest of the time your car is standing somewhere. And the idea of the project in Porto Santo Island is to use the car as a storage when it's standing to help the electricity grid manage a lot of renewable energy.
The battery cars will be smart, so they'll know just how much electricity they can afford to sell while still leaving enough for the morning drive to work.
To help persuade drivers to join the electron revolution, the local government will offer subsidies to make electric cars compare on price with petrol and diesel vehicles. Veronica Brandmeier from Mobility House, that's the company behind the reversible chargers, says people need to calculate the hidden benefits too.
If you have a car that can feed energy back into the grid, you can actually earn money during the time it's parked. If there's no renewable energy available, you can feed it back and you earn money. So it really changes the whole idea of owning a car.
The local government needs half the cars on the island to be battery powered to guarantee enough storage for an adequate backup to renewables. The electric revolution will reach into homes and workplaces. In the kitchen of the island golf club, the chef Daniel is cooking on gas. Before long, he'll be frying on electrons that have been carted round the island in somebody's car battery.
The BBC's Roger Harabin reporting from Porto Santo off the northwest coast of Africa. I'm Carol Hills. Berkeley, California is big on recycling. It used to send its bottles and cans to China.
The Chinese factory recycling Berkeley's containers said it wasn't going to take those materials anymore. So the city turned to a broker. That meant they didn't know where their plastic was ending up anymore. They thought they'd better figure it out.
One city and a global trash problem ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Every time you throw a plastic bottle into a recycling bin, do you get that ping of satisfaction, like you're doing your part? Well, as we've been talking about for the past few months, it's not that simple. Yes, some recycling is happening, but not as much as you might think. So for the next part of the show, we're going to take a look at plastic waste, even before it becomes that bottle. It's part of a collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Jamie Smith Hopkins spent months investigating the trail of plastics from production to recycling, including a visit to a recycling processing center in Berkeley, California.
We will get soda, juice, water bottles, milk jugs, detergent bottles, shampoo bottles, cups.
Jamie, who is that?
That's Martin Bork. He heads the Ecology Center, which collects residential recycling in Berkeley, California. The city used to sell its plastic food containers to China. In fact, for years, most of our country's plastic recyclables ended up there.
And of course, now China's saying no, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The problem is that a lot of that plastic couldn't actually be recycled, and China started cracking down. In fact, the Chinese factory recycling Berkeley's containers said it wasn't going to take those materials anymore as a result. So the city turned to a broker. That meant they didn't know where their plastic was ending up anymore. They thought they'd better figure it out.
We were very concerned, and we found an off-the-shelf GPS tracking device
about the size of a deck of cards.
So they actually started tracking where their plastic was going through GPS?
Yes. In 2017, as the Chinese crackdown intensified, one of those trackers popped up in Malaysia.
Hmm. And that's where the world's Patrick Wynn comes in. Patrick, you went to Malaysia to find out what happens to some of the plastic we throw out.
Yeah, it was a very disturbing and eye-opening trip. If you do feel that sort of twinge of self-satisfaction when you toss a plastic bottle in the recycling bin, then you definitely need to hear this. I've come to the Malaysian coast by the Straits of Malacca. Picture fat palm trees, humid sea breeze, tropical birds. We're in a truck, and I smell our destination before I see it, even with the windows up. Oh, it's burning now. Okay, yeah. I hop out of the truck, and I don't know what else to call it, but a wasteland. In this otherwise lush place, there's this flaming heap, gushing thick black smoke.
Wow, this is really bad.
The smell is really, really bad.
That is Tan Sihan. He works in construction, but in his free time, he tracks down illegal plastic dumps, like this one. As we wade in, warm goop sticks to our shoes. The smoke turns our eyes pink. He says, don't be embarrassed if you feel like throwing up.
You will feel like disgusting, okay? You will feel like want to vomit.
We start snooping around, picking through bales of plastic piled up on the roadside, some spilling out of shipping containers. And I do feel kind of sick, not just because of the fumes, but because all this stuff, it's from my country. Electrolyte drink from Target. A tub of Parmesan from Super Value, a Midwestern chain, and so many water bottles. Aquafina, bottled in California, some mineral water from Kroger, and sparkling water from Trader Joe's. And just to be super clear, there is no Trader Joe's on this side of the world.
Most of all this plastic, the main country actually is the USA.
I met Sihan through this network of Malaysians who spend their whole weekends tracking foreign plastic. And as I talk to more people, telling them, I feel bad seeing my country's trash here, they say, well, American guy, maybe you should feel bad.
American people, when you enjoy a lifestyle which is so convenient, do you think about what you dump to other people's country? Were you happy if I dump my rubbish into your house?
That is Pua Le Peng. She's a chemist by trade. In the last year or so, this area where she grew up, it's been invaded by these flaming plastic dumps, burning trash from the UK, Australia, France, but more than any place else, America. The nightmare here started in early 2018, when China started really driving out its most notorious recycling operators, as it had promised to do for years. It's all part of a drive against foreign waste called National Sword. But suddenly, all these strangers from mainland China begin showing up in Leipeng's small hometown, and they start renting land. And soon, she says, black clouds appeared over the town, and a smell like, well, she says, you ever leave a hot iron on a nylon shirt for too long? It's like that, times a million. She says it brought mass sickness, headaches, chest pains, asthma. Even the butterflies dropped dead. It literally hurt to breathe.
And also when I talk more than 5 minutes, I feel very tired already. You know, I lost energy.
They put the pieces together pretty quickly. Followed the smoke, found the illegal sites, found the scrap marked with strange names like Trader Joe's. A few of the really bold residents tracked down dozens of these places and reported them to the local government. There were some raids, some shutdowns. But to Leiping's astonishment and frustration, they just pop up again and again.
Can you imagine that? This government has no function.
Sure enough, even I find a recycling factory that is supposed to be shut down. Yellow tape across the front and everything. Yet when I stick my head over the gate, I see a big machine grinding up plastic bottles and a big flaming burn pile out back. These criminals, they really do recycle a good amount of the foreign plastic. That's how they make money. Grinding it up, reselling it so other factories can make new stuff. It's just that so much of it is too contaminated to recycle, and that's what gets burned. I don't stick around here because sometimes these goons will come out. Not long ago, when Sihan was out on a scout with some others, some tough guy showed up, yanked the keys out of his truck, and told them to never come back.
Thank you.
This is a secret cell phone recording from that day.
The mafia, okay, surround us, warning us, cannot enter this area anymore.
By mafia, he means local tough guys who are in cahoots with the Chinese importers. He says they're the ones who know how to bribe the inspectors, and they're the ones who'll threaten you if you go to the cops. He says they will send text messages saying stuff like,
"We know where your house, then we know where your children study."
And yet, people like Sihan and Lei Peng, they are relentless. They have filed hundreds of reports. Lei Peng shows me a Facebook message from someone she says is in the recycling underworld. It says, "Hey, there is a price on your head. 100,000 ringgit. It's about 25 grand. Her response? When you and everyone you love is breathing toxic fumes, you're already facing death. Yet all this work, going after Chinese criminals and their American plastic, is really stressing her out.
I just worried if someone follow me and then you'll do something to me.
I can never relax, she says. Even this interview, railing against her own country, she finds it embarrassing.
I don't want to criticize my country.
But if a stranger like me shows up with a microphone, someone from the country that is flooding her hometown with junk, she feels like she can't turn down the opportunity to tell Americans, please do the right thing and stop propping up this criminal underworld with your plastic trash.
To American so-called civilized people, you should not deliver to other country. You should handle it in your own country.
Patrick, that's tough to hear, especially when the whole act of recycling, as you say, makes people feel like they're actually doing the right thing. What has to change to make this go right, and where does that change need to happen first?
Change probably needs to happen first in Western countries, but there is some good news coming out of that. Like China, Malaysia has said, we're not taking any more of your dirty, recycled plastic anymore. And if you send it here from places like America or Canada and we catch it, we're sending it back. Also, there is this convention signed by more than 180 countries that's all about rich countries dumping toxic waste on less wealthy countries. Well, they're now considering plastic to be toxic waste. And this is a convention that's signed by everyone from Canada to France to the UK to North Korea. But the United States has yet to ratify it. Mm. So these are all the issues that come out after you've thrown that plastic bottle in the recycling bin. But there are also all of these scary issues that come up before the plastic bottle even gets made.
Okay, so let's bring in Jamie Hopkins again from the Center for Public Integrity. Jamie, what's the problem on your end of the investigation?
So I was looking at the other end of the cycle, plastic manufacturing, which is in a boom in the U.S. at the moment, and the waste that can come from that. And what I started with was going on a nurdle hunt.
Is that a nurdle?
Yeah, that's a nurdle.
What's a nurdle?
Yeah, it's a really funny name. It's actually another way of describing a plastic pellet. These are the products of plastic producers, what they're sending off to manufacturers to be turned into plastic bottles or bags or other items. So I went with Jace Tunnell, who's with the University of Texas at Austin's Marine Science Center, to an island in the Gulf Coast to look for nurdles. It must have looked pretty odd because one couple stopped to ask what we were doing.
We're finding these, not this big one, but these little ones are little plastic pellets. That's the basis of everything plastic.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and so they're getting out into the environment, so we're trying to figure out where they're coming from. So we've got volunteers all over the Gulf of Mexico collecting numbers of them.
Okay, but what's the point of picking up these nurdles?
Well, what Jace Tunnell is doing, he is picking them up, but mainly what he's doing is he's tracking them. In fact, he started something called Nurdle Patrol, and he's asking volunteers, citizen scientists, to go out when they're at beaches and bays and look for 10 minutes to see, do they see any nurdles, and to count them to let him know. And nobody was tracking this in this region. And so as the numbers are coming in, what he's finding is that they're everywhere, in places that are nowhere near plastic processing facilities in some cases.
Clearly, it's not great having these nurdles all around, but are they actually harmful?
Well, so the problem with pellets is that they pose threats when they get out into the environment. That's not where they're supposed to be. Nobody wants them to be there, including the producers, since this is their product. But they do get out. And the issue is that marine animals mistake them as food. Birds and fish, for instance, and that's not good for them. In some cases, these pellets end up picking up dangerous bacteria or toxic chemicals. But even if they're fresh and new, they don't have anything on them, they're filling up the stomachs of animals and making them feel full. Some animals have starved as a result. There's also this question that scientists are still investigating about what does it mean to have plastic, whether it's in pellet form or otherwise, in the food chain? What does it mean for us as human beings? And we don't really know that yet.
Jamie, I know you've also found out that the U.S. is about to make a whole lot more plastic. I'm wondering why, when there's this huge national conversation now about using less plastic.
Yeah, it's coming at sort of an ironic time. So if you ask plastic manufacturers and their trade groups, what they say is the world is growing, developing countries have larger and larger middle classes, and people want and need plastic. But if you want to know why is this happening in the U.S., where the market is already, you know, pretty well saturated with plastic, the answer is there's a lot of cheap natural gas, and natural gas is key feedstock for plastic. You know, if you ask analysts, they say that's why this is happening here, and since a lot of it is aimed to be shipped somewhere else, particularly to Asia, production is happening here because the feedstock is cheap.
But in reality, is there even a need for all this new plastic?
That's the debate. And it's not just about should we be using something other than plastic for packaging like paper. Sometimes the debate is just do we need all the packaging we have? Could we do this better? It's a critical one, especially for the countries that are finding themselves, you know, really sort of overwhelmed by plastic waste.
Let's get personal here. What am I supposed to do as a consumer and as a citizen? I mean, I want to use less plastic, but it's hard to avoid. So say I use a plastic container. Should I put it in the blue bin or should I just put it in the regular trash? I mean, is that a more responsible way to handle it at this point? Let's start with you, Patrick.
Yeah, Carol, I think I understand exactly where you're coming from. But I think the absolute worst take here is, oh, the system is just so screwed up that I won't even recycle. Don't do that. We can't become cynical about recycling, especially as voracious as American consumers are. See what your city is doing. And maybe they're recycling stuff in America and doing it properly. Maybe they've been sending it over to this part of the world in Asia, but they're just now realizing that that's wrong. And so now is a time of upheaval where we're starting to realize this is happening. You can feel free to nudge them in the right direction. But I will say this, the cost of recycling in America and doing it properly and safely, it's going to be much higher than having it done by desperate workers in Southeast Asia. So if your city says, we want to do this here at home, but your fees are going to go up, that may be the cost of a less cruel world so people overseas don't have flaming plastic smoldering in their backyards.
Jamie, I'm curious, after all this research you've done about plastic and where it ends up, has it changed your own kind of buying and consuming habits?
Well, it certainly means that every time I'm deciding, does it go in the trash or does it go in the recycling, it seems like a much more fraught decision than it used to. You have to be aware that just because, for instance, there might be the Chasing Arrows recycling symbol on your plastic doesn't mean that your jurisdiction accepts it in recycling. So I feel like I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out what can I actually recycle? Is there a way for me to deal with my plastic bags? Can I avoid plastic bags? I think it's something that a lot of people now are starting to think about in ways that we really didn't before.
Jamie Smith Hopkins is with the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, and the world's Patrick Nguyen has been speaking to us from Bangkok. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thanks, Carol.
You can read more of Jamie Smith Hopkins' deep dive reporting on plastics at theworld.org. Here's a video making the rounds.
Imagine this for a second. One man with total control of billions of people's stolen data, all their secrets, their lives, their futures.
It looks like Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, but it's not really him speaking. It's a deep fake. That's a digitally doctored video or audio clip created with artificial intelligence technology. Earlier today, Congress held its first ever hearing on deep fakes. Democrat Adam Schiff of California talked about possible nightmarish scenarios.
A state-backed actor creates a deep fake video of a political candidate accepting a bribe with a goal of influencing an election. Or an individual hacker claims to have stolen audio of a private conversation between two world leaders when, in fact, no such conversation took place.
Deepfakes can be used for all kinds of nastiness, including destroying someone's reputation. Rana Ayoub knows all about that. She's a journalist based in Mumbai. When she wrote a critical article about India's ruling BJP party last year, the trolls responded. That wasn't new for Rana, but what happened next was new. It started with a text message from a source.
Suddenly I get a message on my phone, my WhatsApp, saying, I'm going to send you something. It's going to be very disturbing, but please don't react. The moment he sent the video, I saw the first few frames and I just froze. I could not watch it beyond 3-4 frames because it was a porn video and there was my image morphed in it. It felt like there I was out there in public domain, naked, and I just froze.
So someone had taken images of your face and superimposed them on an actual porn video?
Yes, that was the case.
And to the average person, if they looked at it, they would think it was you in the video.
Yes, I mean, if the average person saw it without going into the details that, you know, it's, oh, the hair is not curly, the body is not mine. The average person, I mean, they would just look at the face and say, oh, that's Rana Ayoob. That's what bothered me. And within hours, one of the leaders of the ruling party shared it on Twitter and it was shared some 200,000 times. It was almost on every phone in India. It was on my father's phone, my brother's phone. It was being circulated on WhatsApp, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And I felt like I was naked for the world. I was throwing up. I was in hospital. I had palpitations for 2 days. My blood pressure shot up. I just couldn't stop crying. For the next 2 to 3 months, I did not go on Twitter or Facebook. I remained silent because I was scared that if I did something, somebody would share that video again.
Have you been able to determine who made this deep fake, who created this fake porn video?
No, we have not. I mean, I've not been able to determine this. In fact, when I went to lodge in a complaint with the police station in New Delhi, they were refused to file a complaint because they said, so what? I mean, it's just a porn video. And I said, no, it's my image on it and it's being circulated. So I have no idea who made that deepfake, but I do know that the people who were circulating that video were people from the ruling party. And as much as I hate to confess, it did break me. I mean, there have been many tactics which have been used by the ruling government in the last 10 years to break me. And that has unfortunately never affected me. But this video broke me. It made me a lot more careful. It just instilled a sense of fear in me. I'm trying to get out of the fear slowly. It's still there. It's still there. It's scarring.
At the time, this was last April in 2018, did you have any awareness of what deep fakes were?
I had absolutely no idea. In fact, 3 days before this happened, the publisher of one of the biggest newspapers in India, the Times of India, wrote a tweet that a deepfake is being used in America, and I won't be surprised if it's used in India, to discredit female voices. And I read that tweet and I didn't even know what that meant, so I did not even go very deeply into it. It was only when it happened to me did I start reading about deepfake, so much so that I did not even want to speak about deepfake in my interviews because it's like a weapon. You know, many in India were not aware of it. I felt like if I spoke about it, I would give a weapon in the hands of people who might use it to discredit women they had a grudge against.
That's amazing. So you didn't even want to talk about this whole phenomenon for fear people would mimic it and create more of them.
Yeah. I was scared to even talk about it.
Did it affect your personal life in that did you find yourself having to defend yourself to friends and family?
My family and my friends were there with me like a rock. They did not question me at all. The only person questioning me was my own self and the people who were trolling me on social media using that video. I kept on questioning myself time and again. Was I right in posting personal pictures on Instagram? Was I right in putting personal pictures on social media? But you do that in times like this, you start questioning yourself as opposed to questioning those people who weaponize apps like these against women.
Now, just today, there was congressional testimony about deep fakes and the social and psychological impacts of them on their victims. And your name was brought up specifically. What do you think needs to happen to combat this kind of thing?
You know, I've been asked this question very often about, you know, how do you combat something like this, something like technology, artificial intelligence? I really do not have any answer for this. What I do know for sure is that social media platforms like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, they need to have some checks and balances so that these videos are not shared on their platforms. There are days when I still do a critical story and I see a screenshot of that video pop up on my timeline. So it just haunts me. It continues to haunt me.
That was Rana Ayoob, an investigative journalist based in Mumbai. We end today's program with a short spelling lesson. It's KYIV, not K-I-E-V. That's how Ukraine wants you to spell the name of its capital city. U.S. officials have agreed to make the switch away from the old Soviet and Russian spelling. Oksana Horbach is with Stratcom Ukraine, the NGO that's been pushing for this to happen. Oksana, let's do this right. What's the correct way to pronounce Ukraine's capital?
It's Kyiv.
Kyiv.
Right. I totally understand it's the difficult way to pronounce the name of our capital. But, you know, that's how we self-identify ourselves. So
yeah, I mean, it's important. Yeah. So where did the push for Kyiv, not Kiev, come from?
It was, you know, continuously going on for the past 10 years, at least, until last year when we've been approached by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine and requested to help them with the communication of this campaign that they wanted to launch to make sure that, you know, globally people are using the correct name for our Ukrainian capital and pronounce it correctly.
So social media and a hashtag turned out to be more effective than any kind of press release.
Yes, social media made the trick.
There's political overtones to this too, though, isn't it? I mean, it's Ukraine's trying to reassert itself and say, no, this is the right transliteration. These are the right letters, K-Y-I-V, not the Russian.
The relationship between our countries right now are not easy. It's complicated because of the military conflict that is going on in the east of our country. You know, we feel that a lot of emotions related to that military conflict were imposed on our campaign. However, the idea behind the campaign goes back to like 25 years ago when we became independent, and as the desire for self-identification and correct visibility became something that is very important for us Ukrainians.
Oksana Horbach, the director of the NGO Stratcom Ukraine, one of the leaders behind the push to globally recognize the correct spelling of the Ukrainian capital. We should say that the world's newsroom uses Kyiv, not Kiev. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.